Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! As President Clinton returns from APEC, hailing free trade over freedom, we speak with the head of the anti-APEC conference that ran parallel to the Asian summit. Then, two views on the so-called drug war. We look at Colombia's killer networks, the military-paramilitary partnership, and the United States, and cocaine politics here at home.
It's a kind of modus operandi that if the government wants to say the Contras were not involved in drug trafficking, which they wanted to do in 1986, some small guy becomes a designated liar in the Justice Department, and then the Times and the Post solemnly go to this person and print a story saying that the Contras were not involved in drug trafficking. Doesn't mean that the New York Times really believes it. It means that they have a special relationship to the CIA.
A conversation with Peter Dale Scott. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A Texas militia leader is rallying support for freshman Congressmember Steve Stockman, the Republican from Texas, in his tight December 10th runoff election. In a fax notice illustrated with the Statue of Liberty holding a rifle over her head, Austin attorney Paul Velt is asking concerned gun owners to do whatever they can to help Stockman win. Velt asked volunteers to go to Stockman's Gulf Coast district for one or two weekends to walk precincts, man phone banks, stuff envelopes, or whatever Stockman needs. Velt is an organizer of Peaceable Texans for Firearms Rights and a member of the Safety Committee of the Texas Constitutional Militia. Stockman faces former Jefferson County tax assessor Nick Lamson in next month's runoff, the result of court-ordered redistricting around Dallas and Houston. Organized labor and environmental groups are lining up behind Lamson, and the National Rifle Association and conservative Christian groups are backing Stockman. David Kessler, who extended the regulatory authority of the Food and Drug Administration over products from orange juice to tobacco, announced yesterday he will resign early next year. Kessler said he's stepping down voluntarily after 6 years as commissioner because he had accomplished his major goals. Kessler had become a major focus of the anti-regulatory mood in Washington, and his agency had become the target of broad regulatory reform efforts. Kessler's departure could free the Clinton administration to broker agreements on contentious issues from FDA reform to the controversial plan for the agency to regulate tobacco. Among the things that Kessler is known for is calling for a moratorium on silicone breast implants, improving mammography standards, improving the very controversial genetically engineered hormone to boost milk production, known as BGH, and also approving Alestra, a controversial fat substitute. He issued tobacco regulations to discourage youth from smoking. There reportedly is now proof that Gulf War veterans are more likely to have health problems than troops who didn't serve in the region. The New York Times reports two new government studies support the contention of Gulf vets who say their service led to health problems. A Centers for Disease Control and Prevention study found Gulf vets are more than three times as likely as other troops to have problems. Their complaints include joint pain, skin rashes, fatigue, depression, sleep disturbances, and memory loss. Pentagon officials tell the paper a Navy study had similar findings. The Dalkon Shield Claimants Trust is paying about $340 million this week to more than 51,000 people who were injured by the birth control device. The women already have received two payments from the trust. African states so far have remained firm in supporting Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali for a second five-year term, despite impatience by the United States and some other Security Council members. The United States used its veto last Tuesday, while the other 14 members supported Boutros-Ghali, whose term ends December 31st. Many African nations, as well as France, apparently hope that by not putting forward other candidates, the Council, at minimum, can negotiate a compromise for a two-year term. And Walter Cronkite is disappointed in David Brinkley. Cronkite says his fellow broadcast veteran shouldn't have apologized for calling President Clinton a bore. The former CBS News anchor says Brinkley is entitled to express his opinions. Cronkite says rather than apologize, Brinkley should have put Clinton on the spot. He says Brinkley should have said, "Mr. President, you know now that I think you're boring. You've got 10 minutes to prove me wrong." And you're listening to Democracy Now! The Asian-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit has ended in the Philippines. President Clinton hailed APEC as a victory because Pacific Rim nations promised to eliminate many tariffs on computers and telecommunications equipment in the next 3 years, which could mean billions of dollars in export sales for U.S. companies. Outside the APEC meeting, however, thousands of demonstrators gathered to protest the impact of global free trade on the world's poor. One of the organizers of those anti-APEC actions is Walden Bellow, chairperson of the International Conveners Committee of the Manila People's Forum on APEC. He joins us now by phone from the Philippines. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi. Yes. Good morning.
Good morning. Why don't you tell us what your major problem and what the Manila People's Forum on APEC's major criticism of this Asian summit was?
Well, the major problem that we had with APEC is that it is a mechanism for indiscriminate trade liberalization through the Asia-Pacific region, and that we feel that this liberalization of trade, which is very much part of a package of radical free market economics, is going to be quite disturbing and not beneficial at all to the masses of people in the region. It certainly serves the interests of transnational corporations, but it is likely to have fairly devastating effects on farmers, on small and medium enterprises, on workers, and on the environment. And we have seen how this sort of radical free market economics has created an economic disaster in Mexico, which whose GNP declined by about 6.9% last year. And we have seen how what are called structural adjustment programs by the World Bank and the IMF have institutionalized stagnation in Latin America and Africa. And it is examples like this that make a lot of people here wary about the APEC agenda. The other thing, of course, that many of us in the Asian region fear is that APEC is simply another mechanism that is being utilized by the United States to push its trade objectives, much like it uses Super 301 and Special 301 of the U.S. Trade Act. The big reality to most of us here is that the United States has a deficit, or in 1995 had a deficit of about $160 billion. $120 billion of that was with the 10 Asian economies. And so there is a realization in Asia that really APEC is simply a means to try to solve the U.S. trade deficit by opening up Asian markets and turning the trade deficit into a surplus. So with this new declaration that information technology tariffs would be reduced down to zero by the year 2000, which, by the way, is not binding, many fears have been heightened about the way that APEC is being utilized as a weapon of trade, particularly for the richer countries like the United States.
Do you think it's fair to characterize President Clinton's position as hailing free trade over freedom when referring to human rights?
Yes, I would definitely think so. There is this definition that the APEC elites have that they come in APEC as heads of economies rather than heads of state and heads of countries. And it has been on that basis that President Ramos, for instance, banned José Ramos Horta, the Nobel Prize winner, from coming to the Philippines to join our parallel conference.
From East Timor. I think it's interesting, Walden Bellow, that Anthony Lewis wrote a piece yesterday in the New York Times, an op-ed piece, where he said that President Clinton, it was a piece on East Timor, and said that President Clinton was very careful at APEC not to be photographed with Suharto, the dictator of Indonesia.
Well, yes, I think that Mr. Clinton came here under a cloud of articles had been written about his links with the Lipo Group, the Indonesian crony of President Suharto. And yes, I think there was a major effort to do that. And I agree with you that there is definitely that stand of free trade over freedom that that has characterized the position of both President Clinton and President Ramos when it comes to especially when it comes to East Timor. President Ramos of the Philippines clearly lost a lot by this banning of Mr. Ramos Horta of East Timor from coming to Manila.
Can you describe what the scene was like there over the weekend with the Manila People's Forum, with the protesters going on at the same time that APEC was? What did you do?
Well, let me just say that we had, before the summit, we had the Manila People's Forum, which drew around 600 delegates from both the Philippines and from throughout the Asia-Pacific region. About 250 came from outside the Philippines. And what we came up with was an alternative declaration and plan of action that put equitable development, sustainable development, and fair trade in contrast to APEC's focus on free trade. And shortly after the conference, both the Manila People's Forum as well as other organizations had sponsored caravans to the former Subic Naval Base where the summit was being held. And thousands of people went to Subic, and here they were met by barricades of police that basically had only one thing in mind: to prevent them from going to from reaching Subic, which was about 60 kilometers away. And
in fact, weren't some leaders in the Philippines arrested before the anti-APEC conference took place?
Yes, one very prominent labor leader was arrested on some charges that, on criminal charges, but it was clear that this the timing of the arrest was, arrest was timed to coincide with trying to put him out of commission during the APEC process. So there was all of that, what we might call curtailment of many freedoms, like the freedom of association of people being prevented from going to Subic. There was the banning of Mr. Horta from coming to the Philippines, and there was a very tight screen at the Manila International Airport, which turned back a number of delegates coming to the Philippines who were going to attend the Manila People's Forum. But nevertheless, an international delegation from the forum was nevertheless able to sneak through to Subic Bay. It in fact included Lori Wallach of Public Citizen in the U.S.
Based here in Washington.
Yeah, based in Washington, and Lori, together with about eight other people, went to Subic the night before, and they evaded the tight security screen, and the next morning they, in fact, were able then to move into the front gates of Subic, and they were able to deliver to the Philippine government representatives, who grudgingly accepted the Manila Declaration of the Manila People's Forum, which expressed a fairly strong opposition and condemnation to the sort of free trade liberalization that APEC represents, and put a very strong emphasis on the importance of human rights and economic rights. So despite a strong security cordon, the representatives of the forum did get through and as they had promised that they would be able to deliver a declaration to the 18 heads of state. Now, whether or not the Philippine government distributed that to the other 17 heads of state or even to President Ramos, we don't know. But so there was a lot of real politics and symbolic politics involved here. And one of the things that was very clear was that you do have a significant part of the population in this country is very skeptical of the APEC process. There's a lot of skepticism, if not fear, of the sort of indiscriminate trade liberalization that APEC represents. And there are quite a number of people, that are willing to take the streets to protest the sort of globalization for the few that you might call it. That is the APEC process. Basically, the way APEC is being seen here is that it is a sort of very similar and is an extension of the North American Free Trade Act.
Weldon Bello, I want to thank you very much for joining us, chairperson of the International Conveners Committee of the Manila People's Forum on APEC. He was speaking to us from the Philippines. I should also say, as they were talking about Subic, that at the same time, another conference took place in the Philippines protesting U.S. bases around the world, from Vieques in Puerto Rico to Panama to Japan to right there in the Philippines. And you're listening to Democracy Now! The United States has provided millions of dollars to the Colombian military, they have said, to fight the drug war. But human rights groups say that USAID has actually supported paramilitary units that have engaged in a dirty war against dissidents. These right-wing death squads have used murder, torture, and disappearances to terrorize Colombian citizens suspected of being sympathetic to rebels. Human rights groups are calling on the United States to suspend hundreds of millions of dollars worth of Black Hawk helicopters, machine guns, and ammunition to the Colombian military. We're joined right now by two people, by Joost Hilterman, who is director of the Human Rights Watch Arms Project, and Carlos Salinas, government program officer for Latin America and the Caribbean at Amnesty International. Why don't we start with Joost Hilterman? Your report came out yesterday, has been condemned by the Colombian government. Tell us what you found.
Well, we found two important things. One, that an important reorganization of the military intelligence network took place in 1991, whereby the Colombian military went into an alliance with paramilitary groups, which, as we all know, have been engaged in killings and disappearances in Colombia for years. And secondly, this reorganization was in part recommended by the United States government, which had sent a team of the Department of Defense and the CIA to Colombia to propose certain changes in the military intelligence structure. So we know that the United States government is implicated in this new arrangement, which led to the creation of a number of killer networks in Colombia, which have led since then to a number of murders.
And Carlos Salinas of Amnesty International, we're not just talking about paramilitary groups, right, but paramilitary groups connected with the Colombian military.
Absolutely. The Colombian military has a long track record of gross human rights violations, and as equally as long has been the U.S. involvement with funding, with training, with assisting the Colombian military. So I think what human rights groups right now are trying to ensure is that the United States government ensure that it inform everyone of who is getting the assistance so that we can monitor that assistance, and also making sure that it does not continue to be complicit in all these murders.
Do you think the U.S. government is well aware of what is going on and how the money and weapons and training are being used?
I think so. Back in 1994, Amnesty International called on the U.S. government to provide further details on its assistance program to Colombia. As a result of that, the United States did provide a list or produce a list of different battalions and units that had been identified by Amnesty as being implicated in gross violations, and detailed the amount of lethal aid these units had gotten. Now, it would be interesting to see the other list, that is, the list of all the units in Colombia that had received U.S. assistance, to do a cross-check and a cross-reference with all of the violations that they may be implicated in.
Well, we're going to have to break, and then when we come back, I want to find out about some of the specific cases that the paramilitary and Colombian military are implicated in Colombia, as we talk about the so-called drug war that the U.S. is waging around the world. We're then going to go to Peter Dale Scott, an interview Larry Bensky does with him, to talk about cocaine politics here at home. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Let's hear what the State Department had to say about the Human Rights Watch report that came out yesterday on the Colombia killer networks and their relationship to the United States.
It says the State Department officials now acknowledge they could not track the aid sent to Colombia.
No, I don't think that's the case at all. I think we have a program in place and we follow up vigorously. Whether it's possible to, you know, follow up on how every particular item is used on any given day, I mean, that probably gets us a bit beyond our capabilities. But if any of, if a helicopter, for instance, is used in a counterinsurgency manner as opposed to a counter-narcotics manner, and that is a pattern, we pick that up. We take action, yes.
And that is Nick Burns, the State Department spokesperson. Joost Hilterman, director of the Human Rights Watch Arms Project. What's your response to his comment?
Well, I think the United States government is quite well aware of what is happening with the military aid that goes to Colombia. First of all the counter-narcotics operations are carried out by the police, or the vast majority of them. And the aid going to those units we have no problems with. But a lot of military U.S. military aid is going to Colombian military units, which clearly have been linked to paramilitary groups, and which themselves have also committed abuses. Now, U.S. and U.S. monitoring reports acknowledge that military aid has gone to 24 military units, which it is have widely reported to have used torture and death threats and have killed people. So it is rather incredible for the State Department not to declare that they have no knowledge of these matters.
I noticed that at the beginning of your report, before your summary and recommendations, you talk about a human rights activist that helped you with putting together this report and documenting the U.S. relationship with the Colombian military. His name was Wilson Jose Caceres. What happened to him, and who was he?
Well, he disappeared. This was in 1995. He was a local activist. He was involved in political activities, and he was also involved in human rights activities. And he was on his bicycle one day, and he was at one point he just disappeared. He was no longer seen. But a paramilitary group was known to have been in that area at that time, and we have no further news about him. But he was there in part. On that day, he was arranging meetings for our researchers.
Carlos Salinas of Amnesty International, a typical story?
Well, a typical story could be back in 1993 when the artillery battalion of the 13th Brigade entered the home of a leftist activist, went in, killed him, killed his children, killed an infant, and then later tried to pass it off as a clash with guerrillas. But I'd also like to get back to the point about Mr. Burns. One, if they can't track the assistance, and we all know what record the Colombian military has, maybe they shouldn't be giving this assistance, because they're obviously not being very responsible about how they're using taxpayer money. I don't think people in the United States, people anywhere, want to see their money being used to murder innocent people, such as this human rights activist, such as this family that I just mentioned. Second point, Mr. Burns better get with the program, because The Congress just passed a law that prohibits counter-narcotics assistance going to any unit implicated in violations. If he can't track it, then he's probably risking breaking the law, and I don't think that would be a great position for the spokesperson and the State Department to be in.
In the reports that have come out both by Amnesty and Human Rights Watch in the last weeks, it's pointed out that the Colombian military that works with these paramilitaries, the people there are not only not disciplined, but they are promoted.
Correct. And in fact, just last week, we have two reports of this collaboration with the military and the paramilitary. One is a case of a meeting on the 15th of November, where a paramilitary group is drawing up a death list with a unit of the Colombian military called the 40 Heroes of the Korean War. And then just on the 18th of November, there's an arrival of a paramilitary group to a place where they go around and kill people. In the meantime, it turns out that their arrival had been announced by counter-guerrilla battalion number 4, the so-called Granaderos battalion. So here, just last week alone, you have two very specific cases of this collusion and very tight collaboration between specific military units with their paramilitary allies. But you have to remember, while the paramilitaries are doing a lot of the killings, so are the Colombian military.
We're talking about Colombia's killer networks and their relationship to the United States. And then we're going to be speaking with Peter Dale Scott. Larry Bensky will be talking to him about cocaine politics here at home. Last week on Democracy Now!, we talked with a Special Forces Master Sergeant, and it's rare that you get these people to speak in public about what they do. But he talked about the clear political agenda that the Special Forces were carrying out on behalf of the State Department and the U.S. government. Joost Hilterman, in your report that you've put out, that Human Rights Watch has put out, you talk about the U.S. military and those special forces groups that have gone down to Colombia. What are they doing there? How many are there?
Well, ostensibly, they're there for junior leadership training of Colombian commissioned and non-commissioned army officers. In 1996 itself, there were two deployments of 52 U.S. Army Special Forces officers. And in 1997, further deployments are expected of even larger number of officers. What exactly they're involved in, we do not know, but we do note that a lot of the training that is takes place in towns that are known to be paramilitary centers. So at army bases at those centers, and also army bases where Colombian army units are based that are not at all involved in the counter-narcotics struggle. So we have very grave suspicions about what the activities of these special advisors, in fact, are.
Let me end on this question. If the United States knows well what is going on, what is being done with the money, the training, the weapons that they pour into Colombia, what is the U.S.'s agenda there? We'll begin with Joost.
Well, I think you ought to pose that question to the State Department. But I think that there is one excuse, which is that, in fact, the guerrillas are also involved in drug trafficking, and therefore U.S. military aid is in fact going to the fight against drugs because of that.
That's right. In fact, the Colombian government, in response to your report yesterday, said that you should instead be focusing on this unholy alliance between narco traffickers and rebels.
Right. Well, that ignores the fact, of course, that a lot of the top paramilitary leaders themselves are also heavily involved in the drug trade and at a much higher level of production and trade than the guerrillas, who are just growing poppies out in the fields. But it's the paramilitary leaders who are, in fact, involved in the trade to the United States. So what the real U.S. interest is, again, you have to ask the U.S. government, but I suspect that it has something to do with supporting the Colombian government against insurgencies.
Carlos Salinas, do you share that view?
Pretty much. I don't think it's any coincidence that in the same year that the Berlin Wall crashed is the same year that the drug traffickers declared the new public enemy number one. And what you have is sort of the same military system and military-to-military relationships continuing, but now shifting. Now it's not anti-communism, now it's anti-drug traffickers. So I think that's an element we need to keep in mind.
And is it really anti-drug traffickers?
Well, that's, I think, a big question because I think the State Department is being disingenuous when they are saying the guerrillas equals the drug traffickers. I think if you're going to talk about narco guerrillas, you have to talk about narco paramilitaries. Narco militaries, narco fill in your name here. Because as we all know, drug traffickers make alliances with anyone they can.
Well, I'm sure people would like to get a copy of your report, so why don't we get some phone numbers? Well, let's begin with Joost Hilterman of Human Rights Watch.
To get a copy of our report, please call 212-972-8400 in New York. Our publications department would be more than willing to send you a copy.
That's 212-972-8400 for Human Rights Watch. Amnesty International?
Our phone number is 202-544-0200 and ask for extension 235.
That's 202-544-0200, extension 235. Carlos Salinas and Joost Hilterman, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
From Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. And you're listening to Democracy Now! And we're going to continue on this theme of drugs. This morning, the Senate Intelligence Committee will hold its second hearing on charges that the CIA knew that Nicaraguan drug dealers were bringing crack cocaine into South Central Los Angeles, but did nothing to stop it because profits from that crack trade were supporting the Nicaraguan Contras and their war against the Sandinistas. The charges were raised in a controversial series published by the San Jose Mercury News in August that's led to three official investigations, including one led by Senator Arlen Specter, who's chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Today, the committee will question two former Contra leaders, Adolfo Calero, who used to head Coca-Cola under Somoza in Nicaragua, and Aiden Pastora, one person who's been researching the CIA's involvement in drug and weapons deals dating back to the Second World War. Is Peter Dale Scott, now a retired English professor at the University of California at Berkeley. Scott co-authored the book Cocaine Politics, Drugs, Armies, and the CIA in Central America. He spoke with Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky about the current controversy over the CIA and drugs based on Gary Webb's series in the San Jose Mercury News.
Peter Dale Scott, I'd like to discuss with you some things that perhaps have not been discussed sufficiently on this program, on Pacifica, or in the media in general concerning the fallout of the Gary Webb series in the San Jose Mercury News. And I'd like to begin by getting your reaction to a couple of statements made by Jack Blum, the former special counsel for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, better known as the Kerry Subcommittee on Narcotics, Terrorism, International Operations, which had hearings on this back in 1988. Jack Blum, when he opened the hearings held recently by Senator Specter, a statement which was broadcast on this program, by the way, said the following. We found, referring to the Kerry Committee, no evidence to suggest that people at the highest level of the United States government adopted a policy of supporting the Contras by encouraging drug sales. For the most part, the Contras on the ground were forgotten men, short on both supplies and money. The drug trafficking some Contras engaged in went to line their pockets, not to help their political cause. There are two parts to that. First of all, his statement that they found no evidence to suggest that people at the highest level of the United States government adopted a policy of supporting the Contras by encouraging drug sales. Your reaction to that?
Well, you know, it was very difficult to set up the Kerry Committee. And it's quite obvious that there was a deal made in setting it up that they would not look directly at the CIA. In fact, at one point, one of the defense attorneys for a witness accused Kerry of trying to bring the CIA into the picture. And Kerry's response on the record in the hearings is very instructive. He said, I have been very, very careful here. I have stayed away from naming any companies that are CIA proprietaries because I have an agreement with Senator Boren. Well, Senator Boren was the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and obviously Kerry's mandate was not to get into the mandate of the Intelligence Committee. So what Blum is saying there, I think, is technically correct, but it's true because they weren't looking at the highest level.
They couldn't look at the highest level, according to what you're saying, according to what the deal was to allow them to have these hearings.
Exactly.
All right, how about the second part? For the most part, the Contras on the ground were forgotten men, short on both supplies and money. The drug trafficking some Contras engaged in went to line their pockets, not to help their political cause. When I first read the Gary Webb story, one of the light bulbs that went off in my mind, or I should call it rather an alarm bell, was the economics of what was being proposed as the fallout from the drug sales in the United States, and specifically Los Angeles, going to the Contras. It didn't and doesn't accord with what I understood the financing of the Contras to be at the time in question. What's your take on that? Who got money? How much money? Where did it go?
Well, let's approach it from the drug end. I think it is a fact that it's not so much Contras, but Contra supporters. That's really the status of Norman Meneses and Denino Blandone. And there were many, many other people like them, people who were participating in the Contra support effort and who were also drug trafficking. And I want to say, in opposition to the New York Times and the Washington Post, that the amount of drugs handled by all of these people was very, very big, much bigger than what was handled just by Meneses and Blandone. They were only two parts of a massive effort. And that the amount of money that was going to the Contras was also very big. The problem is, it's extremely expensive to support an army. And even if you have millions, and that's what we're talking about here, millions of dollars going to the Contras, they could still be indigent and not getting enough to eat, particularly because of the corruption at the top level of the Contras. It wasn't filtering down to the troops.
All that the Contra supporters, however, were asking for in aid in this period under question in the Webb series, which is to say the early 1980s up until cutoff time and Boland Amendment time in 1984-85, was something like $2 million a month. They said that that would be adequate to fund their forces, and that was what was being officially allocated. Why would they have needed, wanted, or been able to use more money than that, unless, of course, as you say, it never got to them, and as Blum says here, and it was raked off by various crooks along the way, posing as Contra leaders or Contra supporters?
Yes, well, I think some of the bona fide Contra leaders were also bona fide crooks and lining their own nest. There is a case in Oklahoma in which there was a witness, and what's interesting about this, he is a government witness, and what he testified to that's interesting to us came out under cross-examination. And he testified he'd been a pilot for Jorge Morales, or George Morales, in Miami. It was clearly a sanctioned operation because they were told to fly their contraband shipments of cocaine into customs-controlled airports, which is not the normal style, of course, of drug traffickers. But they were told, in this case, you do it, and they did do it, and there was no problem. And he testified that he personally had delivered millions to Contra leaders. It may not have reached the Contra troops, but the funds were certainly getting to the Contra leaders.
Now, this, of course, should have set up some serious alarm bells in those who were allegedly the control agents of the Contras, who knew what their economic needs and situation was, and who might also have known, should also have known, could hardly have avoided knowing that this drug trafficking operation was going on, this guns in, drugs out, Central American operation. Were those people necessarily in the CIA, and at what level? The ones who could have, should have, and almost obviously did know.
Well, Alan Fiers, who was head of the Central American Task Force for the CIA, and therefore, you know, I'm a senior CIA officer and very much in the know, he actually testified that to the Iran-Contra Committee that they knew there was drug trafficking. And what he chose to talk about, a lot of his testimony is, to my knowledge, is still not being totally declassified. It wasn't when I read it. but he admitted that they knew about the drug trafficking. Then he targeted the people who surrounded Aden Pastora. And obviously,
so-called Southern Front.
Yes, and in Costa Rica. And he was talking about a period when Aden Pastora was no longer in the good graces of the CIA. And in fact, there had been this famous bomb explosion in which we still don't know the full story. But the CIA, many people think, were implicated in that, or some of their people were. So he was conceding it was a well-known problem. He was just trying
to limit the problem to a Contra leader with whom the CIA had fallen out of favor. The fact is, it was happening all over the place, and if we just draw back for a moment, this is a normal CIA modus operandi. They had just come off this huge operation in Laos in the 60s and the 70s. And again, an enormous amount of government money went into Laos. Wasn't enough to pay for the whole operation. The Royal Laotian Army ran the biggest heroin refinery in Vientiane, and everybody knew it except, quote, the U.S. Embassy.
Peter Dale Scott, co-author of Cocaine Politics, Drugs, Armies, and the CIA in Central America. We'll be back talking with him in a moment. We'll talk about the question of whether or not the CIA was involved with crack cocaine in South Central Los Angeles, and also, what the heck is this CIA we're talking about anyway? Stay tuned. I'm Larry Bensky. This is Democracy Now! Peter Dale Scott, I want to get to the question of crack and South Central Los Angeles and the African-American community, fallout of the Gary Webb series, whether or not he actually said that. It certainly is being interpreted that way. But before we do that, you're in a unique position to, I think, help our listeners to understand what are we talking about when we talk about the CIA. It's an executive branch agency. Its director is a bit unusual in government in that he, and it always has been a man, not only heads that agency, the CIA, with a reported $3 billion a year budget, but is also the overseer of the 12 or 13 other government intelligence agencies with a reputed budget of $30 billion a year. So the CIA itself has only a tenth, allegedly, of the official government intelligence budget. Mm. It has something like 30,000 employees, we're told, although we never really know for sure. Mm-hmm. But it itself is divided into different parts. And I have problems, again, not only with the web series, but with the fallout from it, when people say, the CIA did this, the CIA
yes,
did that.
I agree.
Are we talking about an official government mandate where Ronald Reagan, Edwin Meese, who knows who, Richard Allen, William Casey, sat around a room and decided the CIA will, as part of this government's policy, do such and such, or are we talking about something else?
Under the statute of the National Security Act, the CIA was created to essentially inform the National Security Council and perform such other duties as may from time to time be directed. Senator Church raised the possibility of a rogue elephant CIA. I don't think that's the problem here with the Contras. At least in the Reagan period, it's very clear that the whole Reagan administration was behind the Contra effort. And when we come to the real abuses that we're talking about here, very close to the top in my mind is not just the fact that these people were trafficking, but that they were getting away with it. They were protected. And particularly in the case of Norman Manessis, there was a big bust here in San Francisco in 1983, the so-called Frogman bust. It was pretty small by today's standards, but it was the largest cocaine bust ever made on the West Coast at that time. And Manessis, according to my source, who was a Republican and at the time a Contra supporter,
who's mentioned under a pseudonym in the Gary Webb series.
That's right. He's called David Morrison, and I'll call him that there because he had every reason to be frightened for his life. He was receiving death threats. Why? Because he went to the Justice Department and said, you have a problem here. And he learned that there were people inside the DEA and inside the FBI who were as upset as he was that this man was being protected, was told to get out of town before the big... A lot of busts were made in connection with the frogman cocaine, but not the top man.
But you say this was not a rogue operation, and I'm trying to find out from you and from anybody that I can and help the listeners understand where the difference lies between policy and where the difference lies between operations. Yes. What goes on in an agency like the CIA so that when people say the CIA, what the heck are they actually talking about here?
Well, this is actually, I think, a very difficult problem to articulate. And the way I would say it is, I'm sure that on the one hand, there was never a meeting of the Cabinet or the National Security Council where we said, we're going to fund the Contras through drugs. That's absurd. It wasn't like that at all. But what I think has built up over the years and probably actually antedates the creation of the CIA in 1947 is a kind of symbiosis whereby in the Third World particularly, U.S. corporations who want to have influence in small countries like Honduras. Let's take Honduras because it's the quintessential banana republic. It was also the site of the major Contra camp, the FDN. And historically, going back to the turn of the century, corporations have had influence in these countries by corrupting local governments, installing them in the case of Honduras, and doing that by working with local right-wing forces that since the 1930s anyway, have been involved in drug trafficking.
And of course, these are the forces who, in a place like Honduras, control not only the police, but all armed services, control the business structure, and control the government.
Right. And there was a good deal of this in Nicaragua under Somoza. And Meneses actually, I think, was able to become a major trafficker in the Somoza era because his brother was the chief of police.
Now, if we know this, you know this, your book Cocaine Politics was written in the late 1980s, early 1990s, came out in 1991. You and I followed closely the Iran-Contra hearings, the trial of Oliver North, the Kerry Committee, etc., all of which were broadcast in some measure on Pacifica, and I was there for those. We've known many of these details before.
Yes.
At what level do you think it got blocked from really coming out to the public consciousness? Where in the media elite structure or the government elite structure did the gate slam down?
Well, it's—I would have to say—at the highest level in the media and in the government. You know, in Cocaine Politics, there's a whole chapter about the media. We wouldn't be
very important chapter.
We wouldn't be in this terrible mess if it weren't for the complicity of the New York Times and the Washington Post. They are among the best newspapers in the world, and on many if they're talking about corruption in Tanzania, they're pretty reliable. If they're talking about corruption in Washington, they're not reliable at all because they work very closely with the CIA. CIA is a major source for them. There have been the occasional honest story that has come out in those papers about the Contras and drugs, but they're vastly outnumbered by the dishonest stories. It's a kind of modus operandi that if the government wants to say the Contras were not involved in drug trafficking, which they wanted to do in 1986, some small guy becomes a designated liar in the Justice Department, and then the Times and the Post solemnly go to this person and print a story saying that the Contras were not involved in drug trafficking. Doesn't mean that the New York Times really believes it. It means that they have a special relationship to the CIA.
And, of course, Jack Blum, in his opening remarks to Senator Spector's one day of hearings, mentioned the fact that they had had a terrible time getting coverage of the Kerry Committee hearings when they
yes.
were taking place in early 1988.
Can I say a word about that? It was
quickly,
so
yeah.
galling that when the Kerry report finally came out with proof of all these really serious charges, such as a drug airline was used to supply the Contras in Honduras, for example. Both the Post and the Times ran it in the back of the paper and said there was nothing new here. Well, it wasn't new to you and me, but it was certainly new to people who only read the New York Times.
I want to get your reaction to another one of Jack Blum's statements in his opening remarks to Senator Specter's committee, the Senate Intelligence Committee, just a few weeks back, talking about the Kerry Committee again in their hearings. He said, "We found no evidence whatsoever that the African-American community was the particular target of a plot to sell crack cocaine. Cocaine has been and continues to be an equal opportunity destroyer. The flood of cocaine that hit the United States in the mid-1980s ruined whites, Latinos, and African-Americans indiscriminately." Your reaction?
Well, I'm still learning in this area, and I want to be careful. I have been asked many times on radio broadcasts, was the black community targeted? And I have always felt, and said in the past, that I felt it was targeted by indirection. You know, that they obviously, particularly at the back in the time of the Black Panthers and so on, there were a number of COINTELPROs that were directed specifically against the Black Panthers and other black leaders, including quite moderate leaders like Martin Luther King. This is no secret. It cannot be denied. And it became pretty clear, I think, that law enforcement at all levels, from the local up to J. Edgar Hoover, they much preferred to see black communities dominated by capitalists, even if they were criminals and traffickers, than by radicals like the Black Panthers. I saw it with my own eyes when the nonviolent anti-war march that started in Berkeley got to the border of Oakland. The Oakland police were waiting there, but the march was actually broken up by the Hells Angels, who were the major distributors at that time in Oakland. And it was obviously...
Of speed.
Of speed, yes. And it was obviously something being tolerated by the Oakland police. I've always said in the past that I thought it was that kind of indirect fallout that has afflicted the communities. I must say, I've been studying how crack markets are created, and they don't just grow. It's clear that what happened in Los Angeles is a model for what's happened in the nation. People go in, create a crack market.
Or do they use the traditional American merchandising strategy, which is why Wendy's opens up next to McDonald's, opens up next to Taco Bell, opens up next to Pizza Hut, because the African-American community had already, and one could say this was a previous nefarious activity, of course, had an established market for heroin, for example, established market for marijuana. It was easy to establish a market for crack cocaine because there was already a commercial or a mercantilist, if you will, predilection towards having a drug sales network.
Yes, but there's something hard-edged about the creation of crack markets. People go in, start it, and you can date when it was started. And it's very ironic that the day that I think it was that Tim Golden of the New York Times was speaking, was supposed to speak on the Berkeley campus about this, the New York Times actually ran an article about a Dominican trafficker in which they conceded that there was a date in 1985 when crack hit New York 1 month after a market had been created for it in Los Angeles. I think that whether those dates are actually precise or not, it tells us that there is something specially artificial about the creation of crack markets, which is, I think, I would like to study more about this. Initially, I myself was among the skeptics who thought that Gary Webb might have overstated the importance of this connection going into the neighborhoods of South Central L.A. I now believe that crack markets are created and that Danilo Blandone, with an MBA from Columbian University, was an expert in market creation and therefore was a major factor in the spread of crack down there.
Well, we never know about Mr. Blandone because apparently now the Justice Department and the federal courts are seeking to quickly deport him from the country. something that is being protested by Maxine Waters and others, but we'll see how that plays out over the following few weeks. Peter Dale Scott, finally, your reaction to a statement again by Jack Blum and opening up the Specter Committee hearings. He says, if the question is, did the CIA sell crack in the inner city to support the Contra War, the answer is a categorical no. If you ask whether the United States government ignored the drug problem and subverted law enforcement to prevent embarrassment and to reward our allies in the Contra War, the answer is yes. Is he making a distinction without a difference here between the crack sales, the CIA, and the United States government ignoring the drug problem?
Well, I think all of us will sound more credible if we stress that it was Contra supporters who actually sold the cocaine. The kicker is in the very end of what Jack Blum said there. It's not really so much that the government ignored the problem. It's that they subverted the law enforcement process. If you think about it, that means they weren't ignoring the problem. They were paying attention to the problem and taking care to see that the key Contra supporters were protected. That, to me, is the central issue. And that is my anger at the Washington Post and the New York Times, both, that they have tried to fudge that issue by attacking Gary Webb for things he never said at all.
Well, one of the things, of course, that they're doing, and this comes back to where we began to speak in this conversation we're having, is trying to, in some cases, pin down the economics of it, saying, for example, in the Washington Post, that there could have been only $30,000 to $90,000 passed along, that this was a tiny drop in the bucket of the amount of money that it would have taken officially and extra-officially to fund the Contras. Are we ever likely to get anything approximating reliable data on this?
Well, we can certainly, I think, speak to those figures. What the Post did was magically convert the whole issue into the actual amount of money handled by Meneses and Blandone. There were many, many, many Contra supporters. There was just Jorge Morales, for example, in Miami, who's just one more. One of his pilots says that he personally saw millions of dollars going to the Contras. The biggest supporters of the Contras at the time, who profited from this situation to get into drug trafficking, were the Honduran army and the so-called Guadalajara cartel in Mexico, who had a representative in Honduras called Juan Mata Ballesteros. The DEA was quoted in Newsweek back in the 80s as saying these two, so they were actually just talking about one of them, could have supplied from 30 to 50% of the cocaine reaching the United States. I don't think you can arbitrarily separate the Honduran army from Mata Ballesteros, but there were two shipments, just two single shipments from traced back to the Honduran army that were intercepted, and they totaled 6.7 tons, just those two shipments. So
a lot more than $30,000 to $90,000.
So what we can safely say is that despite everything that had poured out of the Justice Department and the Times and the Post, this was a major factor in our drug problem at the time. And common sense would say this because we didn't really have a cocaine epidemic in the country until the Contras began, just as we never had any heroin in this country from Afghanistan and the Pakistan border until we started supporting the guerrillas there, and we were suddenly flooded with heroin coming from the so-called Golden Crescent. There is a very clear historical correlation between flows of drugs into this country and where we have major covert operations.
Peter Dale Scott, who is co-author of Cocaine Politics, Drugs, Armies, and the CIA in Central America, co-author along with Jonathan Marshall, a book published by University of California Press. It's still in print. In fact, it's out in paperback now, and I believe had an update in the paperback edition from its first edition in 1991. Peter Dale Scott is also author of Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, and that was published again by University of California Press. Peter Dale Scott is a retired professor of English at the University of California, Berkeley, also a former Canadian diplomat. Thank you very much for joining us today on Democracy Now! We, of course, will continue to follow this story and eagerly look forward to speaking to you again as you follow it yourself.
Thanks very much.
That's right, Larry. Tomorrow we'll bring you excerpts of today's Senate Intelligence Committee hearing on the CIA-Contra cocaine connection. And on Thursday, back by popular demand, the amazing story of the friendship between an African-American civil rights activist and the former Grand Cyclops of the Ku Klux Klan. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin. Our engineer is Kenneth Mason. I'm Amy Goodman for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!